And we've got a real treat for you today on this AvWeb AudioCast, brought to you by Aviation Safety, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention. And you can read this month about aging aircraft, automation complacency, aircraft accident details, analysis, training tips, maintenance problems, and much, much more. You can check it out at aviationsafetymagazine.com. Although the Apollo astronauts got most of the glory, NASA's unsung flight controllers came into their own on Apollo 13 when an oxygen tank exploded and disabled the spacecraft on the way to the moon. Cy Liebergott, a Cal State-trained engineer, was lead ECOM, that stands for Electrical Environmental Consumables, on that mission. Liebergott spoke recently at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach, Florida. AvWeb's Paul Bertarelli caught up with him there.
By about 1967, the Apollo program was running full board, had been for a while, coming up on the first lunar mission in 69. In the Mercury Gemini missions, flight control had evolved considerably. Did anyone in NASA, or maybe should I say, did you have any sense of how critical that ground support would eventually be?
Well, it was easy to recognize how important the ground support was because we had people in remote sites around the world to make sure that we had people with the knowledge of the spacecraft to be able to help if the spacecraft went over for a short pass, you know, telemetry pass. No, that was pretty evident. We needed people on the ground. That was a given.
This was all relatively new. So would the training be for ECOM? How did that training work out? You kind of had to figure it out on the fly, didn't you?
Well, I wasn't a training guy, but the training guys, in a lot of cases, I say in my book, were smarter than we were. They would look at our procedures and look at our flight mission rules, and they would figure out where the weak spots were, or they would decide to test our willingness to make certain decisions. And I don't know why none of those guys became flight controllers. They were content being in the gotcha game. They did well.
Were there nooks and crannies of the spacecraft that were a surprise to you that you didn't know about or that interacted in ways that you didn't expect?
No, we were pretty good about that. We actually, for example, in the sequential events control system, which controlled the parachute deployment and separation sequences of the spacecraft, which involved pyrotechnics and the docking mechanism. We actually figured out if for certain third level failures, we would take panels off the inside of the spacecraft and locate where the wires were that we had to cut and splice to get around a failure. And we had those wires marked ahead of time behind the panels. So as we went along, we became not more daring, but we recognized there were other failures that were perhaps in the very beginning out of our reach that we discovered, no, we can do that. And we're getting cooperation from the engineering world that, yeah, let's go cut those wires and we'll label them, or we'll label where to cut. And it was a good time because I do believe we kind of kept learning as we went. But I don't think there are any big surprises.
Speaking of failures, let's look back at Apollo 13 through the prism of 38 years of history, if you will. Take us back to the night of April 13th, 1970. By then, you'd been through hundreds of hours of simulation, but none of it anticipated the failure of the entire oxygen system in the Apollo service module. In your worst-case scenario, did you ever think you'd see a failure like that?
No, we never trained for that. To lose that many systems of spacecraft in that fashion was not trained for, because, you know, the structure of a spacecraft had a reliability of 1.0, 100%, and the tanks were the same way. They were just a solid structure, and so therefore they had a reliability of 1. But we never anticipated this kind of failure. However, the simulation guys do is I relate this anecdote that eerily, in mission simulations before Apollo 10, the simulation guys decided that, and we didn't have any lunar module flight controllers. It was just supposed to be a CSM systems failure. Or training sim, and the sim guys decided they would put a leak in the hydrogen tanks. You know, it takes hydrogen and oxygen to feed the fuel cells. And they put an unisolatable leak in the H2 tanks, so we lost all power, lost all the fuel cells. And there were no lunar module guys around to go through the, you know, to say we're going to activate the lunar module and get in the lunar module. It's funny. And we lost the crew. So the flight director that was on at the time said, that's not a realistic failure. We don't have to worry about that. And Apollo 13 was tantamount to the same failure, and the sim guys put it in at 51 hours or within a couple hours of when it actually happened on Apollo 13.
Did the point of the failure, I'm sure you've thought about this and analyzed this, did it happen, if it was going to happen, did it happen at a good point or a bad point?
It was, I now call it my lucky failure, because we had stirred the cryos, the little fans inside the cryo tanks with the charred wiring. We had stirred the cryos at 47 hours into the mission and at 49 hours in the mission. 47 hours was a scheduled stir. But we had the quantity transducer in O2 tank 2 had failed just by itself. And so they stirred the cryos 2 hours later at 49 hours to see if it could jiggle something, who knows. To no avail. Tank didn't explode either of those times. It only exploded when I asked for the extra stir the night before they went to bed. Because the next stir would have been normally when they woke up as part of their post-sleep checklist. And I keep thinking about that, you know, there's no guarantee that the explosion would have happened then either. It was just happenstance that it happened when I asked for the extra one. Now, if it didn't happen, if I hadn't asked for the extra stir, there's no guarantee that it would have happened when the crew woke up and did their post-sleep checklist 8 hours later. However, the wires could have jiggled enough, say when they were around the moon and the lunar module was on the ground, using up all of the consumables.
And that would have been it.
That would have been it. It couldn't have happened at a better time.
What if it happened earlier, say at the beginning of TLI? Would that have made a difference?
We wouldn't have done TLI.
We'll say, or just after TLI was done. Too close in for a free return at that point? Or?
No, we were not on a free return.
Oh, that's right. It was never
on a
free return.
It was the first mission that we decided. You talk about irony. The first mission that we were not on a free return trajectory. And let's see, somebody asked me about that one time. I can't remember what my response was, whether or not it would have really made a difference. Because we had done the burn. The S-4B put us on trajectory to the moon. And it probably, and we weren't using the lunar module supplies, so it'd probably been okay. The only problem is, I got it. No, that would have been bad, because we would have had to activate the lunar module and use its all of its supplies sooner. So even with this massive power down we did, we would have run out of lunar module power. And
it would have taken too long.
We were too early. Mm-hmm. So the closer to the moon we were, the better off we were. So if it had happened when I asked for the extra stir, or happened 8 hours later, still good. Same decisions, go around the moon. Mm-hmm. And have to, you know, readjust the trajectory to be non-free, to be free return. Yeah, that's right. It couldn't happen at a better time.
In those days, telemetry was pretty good, maybe not as good as it is now. How difficult was it to determine what initially happened? What was your initial reaction? In his book, Jim Lovell said his first reaction was a meteor strike. What was your first reaction?
Well, we were both, my backroom guys and we were looking at the cryo information on this one display called the ECS display, and the numbers are very close together. I mean, the quantities and pressures for both. So I told them, I says, look, you watch the hydrogen, I'll watch the oxygen, because the hydrogen behaved differently. When it destratified, I think the quantity went down or changed, and in the O2 system, the pressure would change. I mean, it was just idiosyncratic. And I didn't realize that we were all watching the hydrogen. It was stupid, because 1 inch to the left was oxygen, and we missed it. The data was sampled on board at 10 samples a second, and it was processed on the ground and displayed to me at 1 sample per second. So you could miss quite a bit. So, you know, in 4 seconds, that pressure went out the top, and that was the end of it. And
was the back room confused about it, or were they on top of it? Or
no, they were just like anybody else. What the hell happened? We wanted to believe that the instrumentation was the fault, and because when we look back, without the benefit of a D-log, you know, printout, second by second printout, we just looked at the display data, and the telemetry on O2 tank 2 was gone. So I said, oh, really? And look at that. Now fuel cells 1 and 3 are gone, and here's main bus B and AC bus 2 are gone, and it just all happened within a minute, and it was very difficult to assimilate all that.
And, I think a lot of people don't realize, didn't realize then, probably don't realize now, that flight controllers, the individual flight controllers, had quite a lot of responsibility, and there was a tricky decision-making path that had to happen there. I read about one of the simulations. The spacecraft went around the moon, and the sim guys dropped the cabin pressure by a tenth.
That was me. It's in my book.
Yes, okay.
I'm very self-deprecating. I admit to that. Is Apollo 13?
Between you and the back room, you decided, well, that didn't really represent anything. But when it came around the other side, the cabin pressure had dumped the cabin.
And those are the sim guys who are very clever. They would wait until just at LOS, when the spacecraft went behind the moon, they dropped the cabin pressure by a tenth of a PSI, which is almost like one bit count, as we say. And so you had to make a decision whether or not it was data or it was real. And that was sim guys would do. So instead of being typical and being suspicious, I talked to my backroom guys, and he said, "Ah, it's data. Let's go get some coffee." Came back around, and the cabin was at 0 PSI, and the command module pilot was buttoned up in a suit. Now what do we do? So we just worked what we had presented to us, and we actually did some lifeboat procedures, because what we were faced with was we had plenty of supplies in the command service module, but the ascent stage of the lunar module didn't have any consumables really, but it didn't have a punctured cabin. So we had to work a problem where we would live in the lunar module and occasionally come into the command module. You have to dump both cabins and make long hoses and come into command module to forage for supplies, take them back over, repressurize the lunar module, and actually it was workable. And so at some point, Cran says, "Okay, we've had enough out of that. Let's go into the next simulation." And he was very kind to me. I think the reason being, even though I screwed up and missed that by not being suspicious enough, I think he saw that I was willing to work the problem that we were presented with, even and we exacted benefits that we wouldn't have done otherwise. So,
Everyone, I think, generally agrees that Apollo 13 was NASA's finest hour, certainly one of them. Looking back on it 38 years later, do you still think that? And if you don't, why don't you think that? And if it, did you think you did everything right? If you had anything to do over on that particular mission, what would it be?
Well, first of all, let me tell you that. The finest hour for us was Apollo 13, for us flight controllers or flight operations people. Not for NASA generally. The finest hour for NASA was Apollo 8, when we beat the Russians around the moon for the first time. Because they were, if that booster of theirs hadn't exploded, I mean, they were going to beat us. So that was a guts decision, and there was no risk aversion there. And Apollo 11 followed that, but our toughest mission and brightest mission was Apollo 8, and Apollo 11 was that. Anyway, and the brightest mission for the flight controllers, of course, flight operations people, was Apollo 13. And no, there's nothing I could have changed. As fate had it on Apollo 13, anything I would have done wouldn't change the outcome at all. Not at all.
In his book, Mike Collins, the command module pilot on Apollo 11, once said that he thought the chances of stranding the crew on the lunar surface were about 50-50 on that mission, on the first attempt. What did you have any sense of that at the time? What was your feeling about the
Never.
relative risk?
I don't think any of us really thought about the risk of. I think we had done Apollo 11 was just a natural result of a well-disciplined, carefully thought-out engineering plan, test plan. Apollo 8 was political. Apollo 9, we tested lunar module for the first time, and albeit in Earth orbit. Apollo 10, we went to the moon. We went into lunar orbit. We went into a descent orbit, got within 10 miles of the lunar surface, 50,000 feet, and we couldn't have landed because there wasn't any fuel or enough fuel, or it was too heavy. We did that, and the only thing we didn't do was land. And Apollo 11, we landed. So that was a we it, we just believed it was a natural progression. The training was such that I believe Gene Kranz thought we were about as prepared as we could be, especially with the 1201, 1202 computer alarms, overflow alarms.
Yeah.
And the as Gene wrote in his book, the sim guys pulled that one out for us. They're the ones that discovered that. So they threw that in the simulation that we went to hell to do. And it finally,
Fortunately, though, that wasn't an econ problem, was it?
No, it was a guidance officer guy. And we had a bright guy in the back room named Jack Garman that gave the go for that. And all what Steve Bales did, he was in the front room, just within a millisecond, said, "We're go." Yeah, that was pretty well known. It was kind of nice to tell the crew that don't bother with that. Just ignore those alarms.
Several of the Apollo astronauts, notably Edgar Mitchell and Buzz Aldrin, have spoken about being profoundly, almost spiritually changed by the lunar missions. Have you personally been changed by that? Do you think of it often? And was it a life-changing event to be involved in this program?
No. For me, although none of us ignored the excitement of sending people to the moon, for us, the excitement was watching it happen, and it was no life-changing. Ed Mitchell was quite spiritual. Buzz Aldrin, in his own way, was spiritual and commercial. But for us guys, I don't want to say it was just a job. It was not a job. It was an exciting job. And every now and then, when we allow ourselves to think about it, I said, "Damn, we did that. We were part of that. We may not ever do that again."
Listening to some of the questions tonight in your lecture here at Embry-Riddle, I have to wonder, do people who are born after the program really get it? I mean, do they understand the significance of the engineering achievement and the technical achievement?
Not sure. Not sure if they do. Most of my talks today to the different engineering classes, I didn't get any engineering questions from them. A couple about the movie. And I was kind of disappointed. They didn't kind of poke around. So maybe it's not that important to them. It happened in the past, and so be it. Let it be in the past. And I think that may be the case. I mean, how can they appreciate it if they didn't experience it?
Well, I think the only way you can is if you're a student of history, technical history, and engineering history, yeah. And then you pick up the books on that and be absolutely amazed about what was done. Technology that's a shadow of what we know today.
Well, and then you have to consider the spinoffs from Apollo, the technological spinoffs, which NASA has always done a poor job of marketing because there's so many of them, and what do you just put a list out? So now and if people want to get a good feel for that, I would really recommend that they read, they can read all the astronaut books they want, but they should read Apollo Race to the Moon by
Chaykin?
Catherine, not Chaykin, that's an astronaut book,
yes.
By Charles Murray and Catherine Blyke Cox. Mm-hmm. They are just amazing people. Her political sciences decided he wanted to write a book about Apollo history. That book is, in my view and many of my colleagues, the definitive book about how we did the Apollo program.
Looking forward a little, I assume NASA still has ECOM controllers. How has the job changed?
Different, yeah, it's different now. What happened was when... And that's among the reasons that I decided to just end my career as a flight controller, because when Shuttle came along, it turned out it was a lot more complex vehicle. It, in some cases, a lot of cases, three deep redundancy. And it was a lot more complex to learn, and although it was learnable. And I just decided that I didn't have another mission in me of sitting at a console watching data and learning a new spacecraft. But it was a lot more complex, and what happened was is when these flight controllers, so-called ECOMs, got in there, they said, "All I'm doing is boring holes in the sky, going round and round," and the attrition rate was quite high. And what they did as a result of that was they found they couldn't train the people fast enough that they lost, and they had to split the job up into less responsibility. So now it's split up into at least three different positions. So the old ECOM, gone.
Less interesting job?
I don't think it's less interesting, is because that's all these guys know, that these girls are guys now. But the challenge and the tradition isn't the same that it was from Mercury to Gemini and through Apollo and Skylab. You know, in Skylab we had we had an ECOM for the CSM, but the Skylab ECOM was called Eagle, and that was complex. And that burned a lot of people out because... the way we had to work. So they couldn't train the people, and so they're, in my mind, the tradition's gone, even though I'm wearing a shirt that the ECOMs gave me when I gave a talk.
Last question. You've had a remarkable career. It spanned one of the most interesting periods in this country's history with regard to spaceflight. If you had it all to do over again, would you change anything?
No. How could I change anything? I had a series of decision points and events that happened to me that allowed me to make decision points to keep moving inexorably to become a flight controller. And when I wrote my autobiography and I look back at all those the progression of that, I wondered whether I really had a choice in all that sometimes. You know, that old free will versus determinism argument, mm-hmm. philosophical argument. But no, it was, I would change my childhood. But your experiences are what makes you. And it probably made me tough enough to do the job, you know, because you had to keep your emotions under control if you're going to be a flight controller, mm-hmm. especially if you're going to be under stress. So maybe that all that crappy childhood made me a better person to be a stress-resistant engineer. Never know.
Si, thanks very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
Apollo 13 NASA flight controller Si Liebergott. Comments on this audiocast welcome. Audio news at afweb.com. Today's report was brought to you by Aviation Safety, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention. Learn more or subscribe at aviationsafetymagazine.com. For breaking general aviation news, log on to afweb.com. Mike Blakeney reporting for AvWeb Audio. Thanks for listening.